This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2022, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders Educational Programs on March 24 and 25, 2022, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Well, welcome to this session this morning. I think we're a little cramped here. I think things kind of left out a little late upstairs, and so I think we're starting fairly early here. I think there's still people coming in, but we're going to go ahead and get started. That way things can stay on time. Looking at the refugee situation and working in the refugee community that we experience today, I think we stand at a very interesting place in the world. And until recently, the whole refugee thing was sort of out there. It involved other people. But with the situation in Ukraine right now, it all of a sudden feels like it's a little closer home, I think. Most of the refugee situations have involved Muslim people, other things, but suddenly we know of Anabaptists are being displaced because of war and are becoming refugees. So I think today, with that, it gives us a little bit of different feel yet when we think about the idea of refugees and who are refugees and what does that all entail. There are about 82.5 million people around the world right currently who have left their homes. About 26 million of them are refugees, and half of them are under the age of 18. So now I just told you that there's 82 million people, but there's only 26 million refugees. The rest are considered IDPs, internally displaced people. It's essentially the same thing as a refugee, but you're only considered a refugee if you have crossed the border of your country into another country. So if you're displaced within your own country, you're an IDP. If you're a refugee, you have crossed outside. Essentially the same thing, but it does fall in a little bit of a different classification. So it's about 26 million refugees, 50 million internally displaced people, and about 4.4 million asylum seekers. And that does not include the current events of Ukraine, which I think it's in the New York Times this morning. It says that there are roughly 10 million Ukrainians, or about one-fourth of the country's population, who left their homes in the past month. Of the 10 million, about 7 million moved to other parts of Ukraine, while about 3.5 million have left the country. So that's current statistics on top of the 84 million. It's 94 million for today. So just to have that all in perspective of what we're talking about. And I say that we stand at a critical juncture in all of that, because as populations are broken loose and they begin to move, it's a very volatile time. And people are a lot of times questioning what's life about as you get forced out of your home or some other place at any one time. And as populations move, I think we as a people need to be at that intersection, because we can have a huge impact of the life and love of Christ being shown to that group of people. And I have witnessed it. People fleeing out of the Middle East and trying to reach a place of safety. And even as they have traveled to try to get out, they've been taken advantage of. On the route, they've been taken advantage of. Crawled on boats, traveled through very unsafe ways to try to reach some place that's safe. And after you've arrived there, here is a group of people who are caring and trying to serve you and trying to help you. And many people, it's almost overwhelming, because they have fought so much or went through so much to try to get to that point, and suddenly here is someone with open arms. And if we as God's people turn away now from that, I wonder about the accountability that we're going to actually face at some point. Now, especially as I think of of the amount of refugees who have come out of the Middle East and are moving into Europe. The face of Europe is going to change. Now, there's multiple ways you can think about that. One of the problems that Europe has is their population is diminishing fast. And so by default, that makes a vacuum that somebody else is going to fill. So whether you like it or not, it takes, I think, about 1 million people a year right now to sustain Germany's population because it's dropping that quick. So somebody's going to fill that gap. And if we can be the people that meet them on that journey and show them Christ, we can affect what the future looks like there. And if we don't, and then we want to complain about, oh, how the refugees or the migrants from whatever have changed that country, well, guess who we get to look at? Because we had an opportunity and we didn't meet them as we went on that way. And as we think about this idea of how do you serve and what that reality is as they're traveling, and I still think about a man there at the clinic in Bangladesh who just cried when they were taking care of him. He's like, no one ever showed me love like this before. And so I think that that impact on the person cared for and the caregiver, neither one can forget that incident, I think, as we experience that. So it's a great thing. And I think it's something that we should be involved in, but I don't think that we should head into it naively. It's a very complex thing to work with refugees. And I'm going to use the example of the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh as an example of what I'm talking about with some other examples to help show you what I'm talking about. One of the things that happens is a refugee has a history. These things don't just all of a sudden exist. So the Rohingya people are a group of people who are an ethnic minority in the country of Myanmar. They got forced from that country into Bangladesh. Now that seemed like something that just happened, but it's actually an old story. The story goes back to World War II, when the United Kingdom, Great Britain, controlled what we call British India. British India was Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Myanmar. They were in control of that as World War II. They went into World War II, making them part of the Allied armies. Okay? At the end of World War II, Great Britain is so broke they had to spin off a lot of their constituent of their population that they were in control of. So British India became East and West Pakistan and India and Myanmar. Later, East and West Pakistan fought it out, and we have Pakistan and Bangladesh today as they separated. But they were basically the Muslim populations, and India was the Hindu population. But when that all happened, and some powers were sitting someplace, they were trying to decide, like, okay, where are we going to draw the borders for these countries? Oh, here is a river that's running up there. Okay, we'll just drive Bangladesh and Myanmar right up that river. This side's Bangladesh, that side's Myanmar. Somebody somewhere sitting drew that line that was not on the ground talking to the people, which has happened to a lot of borders that happened after World War II. People sat around and arbitrarily drew lines on a map, and you fell on one side or the other. So this group of people ended up on the other side of the river. They look Indian, and they're Muslim, now in a Buddhist-majority country. That shouldn't be a problem, correct? But you have to remember something else. During World War II, they were part of the Allied army. But Myanmar is predominantly Buddhist, and most of them sided with the Japanese. In fact, people ran away from Myanmar to join the Japanese army. So suddenly, when everything got divided up and they were in power, they didn't want these other people in their country. They weren't loyal people. But they were on their side of the river. So they started to get revenge against this group of people. And it just kept increasing and increasing. And they would attack them, and some of them would come over into Bangladesh, and then they would somehow make some reconciliation, and some of them would get back home again, and then it would happen again. And then in about 1982, Myanmar just took their citizenship. They were suddenly no longer citizens. So now they become a stateless people. And pretty soon they started to restrict how many children they could have. They weren't supposed to have two children. So the numbers that they have, the first two children get citizenship, or not citizenship, but recognized as their children, and the rest of them don't exist. So when you start talking numbers, your first two children exist, the rest of them don't exist if you have more than two, because they weren't supposed to have more than two children. So a percentage of the population theoretically isn't, okay? Then they start to restrict their travel. You can't leave your locale without going to the police and getting permission and paperwork to let you travel someplace else. So their travel got restricted. Education was restricted. There's a few that got through somehow to get to universities, but the majority of the people are completely illiterate. And so as things clamp down, of course you know what starts to happen. You start getting squeezed, you start pushing back. And in 2015, supposedly a group of them attacked some police points and killed about 30 people. And of course that set off a military clean out, where they just came in and just systematically just started burning their houses, shooting anybody that was running, raping the women, just wholesale. Bulldozers followed, just leveled the villages, and they began to pour into Bangladesh at a rate of about 10,000 a day. It was the fastest refugee situation to develop since I don't know when. There are larger refugee groups, but it happened over a longer period of time. So like the majority of almost 1 million people crossing to Bangladesh in just a little over 2 months. They come over that fast. Well, they showed up in Bangladesh and there was actually no place for them. They actually just started moving into a national forest, cutting the trees down. The UN and a number of organizations started to provide bamboo poles to put up for a structure and tents or tarps. And in fact, it's restricted to that. They're not allowed to build with anything other than that, which seems a little uncaring. But the truth of the matter is, it's actually for their benefit, for their well-being. And it's hard to see that. But if you understand the dynamics behind it, the place is subject to cyclones or hurricanes. And unless you have a structure that's actually solid enough to hang on to a piece of tin, you don't want tin flying through a refugee camp when a storm hits. So they have enough bamboo and tarps laid back to rebuild the whole camp again on storage, as opposed to letting you have anything solid to build with, which seems, okay, you understand it, but it's still a little hard to accept when you're working with it. So when this all happened, I had been working in and out of Bangladesh a fair amount on other things, and I was also a member of CAM's International Crisis Team. So they asked me to go back over and look at what we could do to work in this camp. When you walk into a place like that, and all of a sudden you have 1 million people. There wasn't even roads into this camp. It was just footpaths. We had to walk for an hour sometimes to get where we wanted to go inside the camp. There was no roads, nothing. Now they put brick paths and roads through it. You can drive through the camp. But and we got there wasn't any. And the observing the size of the of the situation was just about overwhelming. Like what could we even do? If there's 1 million people and we have $1 million, well, we could maybe feed everybody one day. But then what do you do? So like, how do you start to navigate your resources to make a difference? Because the longer it goes, the more I like to marry the idea of aid and a spiritual impact. We can just do aid. There's value in living. I don't have a problem with giving a person a meal so that he can live on. I would like to see something else come out of that gift as well. So as we observe this whole thing, we thought, okay, how can we narrow this down to just serve a repeating part of the population? Because we can't take on this whole thing. That's what the UN does. That's what IOM and all those organizations do. And so as we observed that thing, we realized there was a lot of medical needs that were not being met because actually a lot of them coming out of Myanmar weren't even being served there. They were restricted from it to start with. And then you end up with a camp with 1 million people and there wasn't enough facilities to handle all of that. And so I reached out to Bethany Burkholder, who was working in Myanmar at the time, hoping to reach this people group from the Myanmar side. That's her goal. They had been there was a number of the DNI folks that were there with that goal in mind, only to discover the whole population just transplanted out of the country. They all ended up in Bangladesh. And suddenly they were accessible. There was a German family there that had worked for 20 years to try to reach that area. It was so restricted in Myanmar to prevent them from actually getting to that population group. They had been there for 20 years, and 19 years into it, they had finally started to get the access to that village area, and no more did they get there than the whole population transplanted over into Bangladesh. So they also came to Bangladesh where I met them. We contacted Bethany Burkholder, and some of you maybe know her from working in Haiti. She ran the clinic there for CAM for 10 years. And so I got a hold of her, and she was very interested in coming to Bangladesh to head up working in a clinic there. And we thought, well, by having a clinic, we could sit down in a part of the camp and repeatedly serve a same group of people continuously, where you learn to have relationships with people, not just a matter of numbers coming through. And so we started a clinic there, and we're approaching 4 years now with that clinic. And last year, the clinic there saw 26,000, no, I didn't say it right. We had 26,289 patient visits. I almost said patients. That's not correct, because some of them maybe are diabetic and came back again. And I can't tell you, I can't separate that from how many, the visits from the patients. So there was 26,000 patient visits there last year in our part of the camp where our clinic is. Having said all that, working with refugees is challenging. And I think it's good to be acquainted with some of those challenges so that we can be effective. One thing that can happen is that after a while you can just be overwhelmed with the whole thing. And I saw that early on as we started working. And, you know, everything was in an emergency status. And I said, you know what? If we're going to survive this thing, we're going to have to pace ourselves. Like, we have to start taking control. You know, at a certain time, we're going to stop, and we're going to go to bed and rest, because this thing can overrun you. But one of the things that fortunately happened to us is the government decided that all foreigners have to be out of camp by 4 o'clock every day. So by default, it has to stop. It just has to stop. Because even today, there'll be twice as many patients come as we can see. And you have unhappy people. You just, every day, you have unhappy people that you're dealing with because they're being turned away. We sat here all day. And finally, some of them were actually starting to come the night before and trying to sleep outside the clinic so they could be first the next morning. Then they have like what they call, the camp is broken to sub-camps, and the local director there says, listen, you got to do something about it. You got to put a fence up and stop this. We can't have people being here without some kind of oversight. And so we had to put a fence around and restrict people from entering before morning. But one of the things I think that to be aware of when we start working with refugees is they have experienced terrible things. They have. And it's very easy to sit and begin to listen to those stories, and we start to have good people and evil people. Rohingya are good. The Myanmar people are evil. We can have Ukrainians are good. Russians are evil. You can begin to have U.S. is good. ISIS is evil. You have to stop that. War is evil. People have been used and misused. But if you start to listen to the stories of the Rohingya people, they did some pretty nasty things too. Oh, but you say they did it because they were being... But it's revenge. And revenge is evil. So we need to start to... Listen to the stories, empathize with those stories, but don't make the people evil. There are as many people in Russia that are as unhappy with that war as there are in Ukraine. There are as many people in Myanmar that are as unhappy with what happened as there are Rohingya that are unhappy with what happened. So don't start placing people groups as evil or not evil. There's evil people on both sides. We represent the kingdom of God. We represent Christ and his kingdom. But we don't get sucked into the earthly kingdom issues that go on. And that's easy to do. As you sit there and listen to the horrible things that have happened. But it takes me back to a story. We have a friend of ours who was a Vietnam vet. And he tells a story of being ambushed by a group of Viet Cong. And they shot everybody in his group. He was also shot himself. He was laying on the ground, but he wasn't dead. And after it was all over, the Viet Cong were coming through and kicking the bodies and making sure they were dead, or bang, putting him out, you know, whatever. And he said, somehow they didn't put me out. Like, no one came by him. And he said, after a while, he said, the voices started to leave the area. And as it, after he thought they got far enough away, he set up and looked around. His gun was still laying there, and they were walking away. And he said, I just made jelly out of all of them. Now you start to see who's evil, who's not evil. It happens on both sides. And when it's, and that thing happens, it's ugly. I don't care how you look at it. So don't get sucked into that. Be the kingdom of God. Listen to the stories. Empathize with their situation. But don't get sucked into the evil and the good. That can happen to us. Innocent people are affected on both sides. And a lot of times it's the women and the children. Go look at what happens in the camps. Men are off somewhere doing whatever, and women and children get shipped out. And it's a disproportionate part of the population that happens to. And so a lot of times, most of the people that you're working with are going to be innocent victims of the whole thing, either way it is. How much time do I have? Okay. One of the things I also think it's very, very important to be aware of, and that is what we call a power differential. And I don't know if you understand what that is. We live with it all the time. So it's not something that's foreign to us. We just maybe haven't identified it and realized what we're working with. But if you think about a parent and a child, a parent has control over their child. There's a power differential there. I mean, hopefully. I've seen some children running their parents. But the parent should be in charge and the child shouldn't be. That's a power differential that we have. You have it the same thing in a school. You have a teacher and you have a student. You might think of a boss and an employee. An employee can't fire his boss very easily, but the boss can fire his employee. So there's a power differential that we're working with all the time. And that is a very vulnerable point in aid. In aid. And I want you to think about this if you're ever involved in relief work. But one thing I want to say about that is that aid is the problem. Some people think that somehow that is the problem. That isn't the problem. The differential exists in this world, okay? So helping people doesn't create the power differential. That exists. We just need to be aware of it and work with it. And when I think about that, to try to help you wrap your mind around what I'm talking about, the power differential, in 2015, I was in Nepal after an earthquake. We were sitting on top of a mountain, and we were passing out tarps to people because the buildings had collapsed, and a lot of them still had some walls, but they had no place to get out of the rain. So we were passing out tarps. And we had tarps for everyone. We had arranged prior to that with the village. How many people, how many families or homes are in this village that would need something? And I don't remember anymore if there was 1,200 or 1,600 homes that was in that village. So we had come with that many tarps. And we had a list of names from that village. Who lives in this village and who doesn't live in this village? Because we were targeting this particular village. And we had six lines, I think, running. And as we got to the end, there was people coming up. They're wanting a tarp. Your name isn't on my list. But we need a tarp desperately. And they're down and they're touching your feet and wanting to kiss your feet and trying to do everything they can to get you to give them a tarp. And all of a sudden you realize all the power lies in your hand for good or evil right here. I'm almost the God at this point. I get to say, you know what? I got an extra one back here. I'll give you. Or no, you don't get a tarp. You just don't get one. That is a power differential that you're in. And that can be misused. Be very, very careful with that position. And there's nothing, I don't know what to do about that. That differential exists. And just be aware of it. You can't necessarily make that go away. But there are people who have used that point for leverage. Now, that's one way that it's used, but it happens in other ways. So I have seen there in the Rohingya camp, the camp, for purposes of control, the government broke it down into 24 sub-camps. And then in each sub-camp, they have groups of like 200 families with a person over them called a maji. So anytime they have an announcement, anything that's going to go on, the government contacts all the mazis contact the people that's in their subgroup, that there's going to be a distribution, there's going to be this, that, anything that goes on, that's how it's operated. So there's going to be a distribution. And the mazi says, y'all get to go, but when you come back, you need to give me 2 kg of rice. And if you don't, somebody will meet you in the dark of the night and they're going to whack you a good one. Okay? You will give me 2 kg of your rice when you get back. Or you may go to that clinic, but when you go to that clinic, you're going to bring me so much of this medicine. I don't care how you get it. Lie about your problem. You do whatever you do. You get to go to the clinic, but you're bringing me this. So suddenly, you have this vulnerable person in the middle. How's he going to survive? He has to go to the distribution. But he's also strong-armed with the very item that you just gave him when he comes back. So, being aware of that helps you try to understand a little bit on sometimes how you go about distributions and some of these things, because you can't avoid all of that, the power thing, but I think there is ways to reduce it. And give the person who's receiving the aid as much dignity as you possibly can. So I'll use another example. I was in Kurdistan in about 2014, after ISIS, the whole ISIS thing first started. And there was a Christian group there that was doing a distribution. We were not part of the distribution. We were just along as during an observation, just watching how they did it. So they had, I think it was 5 items that they were given to each beneficiary. So they had 5 skids of stuff sitting here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And at each skid, there was a person standing. So somebody would get their items, and then they would get the next round, and 5 people would each grab 1 item or 2 items or whatever they were given, and they walked it out, and they sat it down right here. And then they kind of stood there, and a name was called. And somebody would come up and bent down and picked up their items and walked away. And I was horrified. It just looked to me like they were bowing down in front of the people that were giving them stuff. And right there I said, I'll never do a distribution like that. Those 5 people that brought those items out, you stand there and hold the item, and when the person walks up, you hand it to them. Look them in the eye. Give them the dignity of a human being. They don't have to pick up the stuff off the blacktop in front of you. You can hand it to them. Try to downplay the power differential. You can't get away from the fact that you are, in fact, giving them relief. You can't get away from the fact that they need the relief. But you can try to give that person the dignity as much as you can. Try to play that. Try to control that as much as you possibly can. Another thing that helps in this whole thing is you need a complaint system. Well, that sounds funny. I mean, after all, they need your stuff. Like, complain about it? Yes, complain about it. If you allow a complaint, a person, just because they're a refugee and needs food, doesn't have to have moldy rice. If the rice we gave you is moldy, I apologize, I will give you a new bag. Allow them to complain about the thing. If there is no way that I can ever say anything about what you just gave me, I am just totally your slave. I'm just completely at your mercy. No, come and talk to me. Tell me if it didn't. And there's a couple different ways you can do that. One of them is simply, I've seen it already where they had at the exit where like you have the setup where they're doing the distribution. In the area where they're exiting, have several people there and a little spot designated. If there's something wrong with your thing, talk to these people. Or just have random people afterwards. Meet them. Hey, what did you get? Could you tell me what was in your parcel? Well, it was 3 cans of this. It was a bar of soap. It was like, okay. That way I know you got what you were supposed to get. Like, give them that amount of credibility to say, no, actually, I only got 1 bar of soap. Well, you were supposed to have 3. And I know it's, well, some of the organizations I've worked with already, they'll put that up here. This is what you should be receiving. And I know sometimes they'll get some organization I've seen will go back maybe a week later and say, what did you get? Do you still have it? If you didn't, what did you do with it? Why don't you still have it? And sometimes like, well, the Mozzie took it from me. Or I sold it. Okay? Don't be alarmed if people sell stuff. Because I'm going to tell you something. Your life consists of more than the 5 items I just gave you. Okay? And I cannot tailor a package for every family's needs. You might have gotten more rice than you need. He's got less rice than he needs. But I need this and you need that. And they'll trade. Or they'll buy and sell between each other. That's okay. What I don't like to see is when the local politician is off to the side strong-arming what happens. Then I'm alarmed. But if it's within the population, I cannot tailor it to meet. I'm okay with that. Okay, so let that happen. Now, another thing that we did there in the Rohingya camp, because they're illiterate, I actually worked to develop a picture complaint card so that. And that was tricky because we worked in a whole different culture. Like, what would you do? How would you decide if you like something? Smiley faces, right? And then a little bit not so happy. And then frowning faces. Did not work with the Rohingya. That was a total... they couldn't make no sense. So, like, what do you picture as being happy? Or what do you picture as being sad? Circle that one on the chart, you know, about did the doctor give you the time? Did, you know, all those types of things. But by having a complaint system, you give a person dignity. And it also makes the aid worker aware of what he's doing, because if he is strong-arming the situation, and believe me, it has happened in every aid organization out here where you will discover that some of their workers took advantage of the population they were serving. It has happened almost in every aid organization. We wish it wouldn't, but by having a complaint system, the person who might be tempted to take advantage of it knows he can be exposed. If you don't have any way for the complaint to happen, he's kind of like, you know, they need my product. They ain't going to say something. And that has happened. So listen, we'll give you this, but you're going to be doing me this favor. And if you don't, and if you tell, your family and your grandpa and all of them will never get another drop. So those things have happened for bad purposes. So by having a complaint system gives them dignity back. Another thing that can happen when we walk into these situations is most times they become 1,000 numbers. There's this big long row of tents and they're just number one, number two, number three, number four, number five. And and you think somehow because that's where you met them, that's who they are. But they didn't grow up in that camp, probably. They just got there. They might have just got there 2 days ahead of you. They might not be any more familiar with that camp than what you are. The people living in that tent, I was talking to a man who left a $200,000 house in Mosul and was living in a camp. $200,000. He was no more used to living in a non-air-conditioned tent, sleeping on a pallet, than you would be. But somehow when we meet them there, that's kind of how they existed before. No, they didn't. And you can't tell the difference between the man who was a doctor and the man who was a taxi driver and the man who was X, whatever you want to imagine, because they're all somehow lost all of that and they're now here. And it's kind of like these poor little people. And me, I'm a doctor. Don't talk to me like that. You know what I mean? So somehow we have to understand all of that. And if we can understand some of that, you can also understand the range of emotions that you're going to find in a camp. And you get them all. You have anger, just pure hopelessness. You have fear, mistrust. People are suicidal. They just want to die. Like, how could just, I can't live anymore like this. I want to die. Selfishness. Some people, they've been pushed, things have gone so wrong in their life that if they don't push to the front of the line, they're not going to get. That's the only way they've survived this far. And you're thinking, well, just don't be so greedy. Just wait. We're going to get to you. And they're looking at that truck and they're going, there's not enough on there for everybody and I'm going to get mine because I've got to have something for my family. And all of a sudden, you begin to understand all those, how you get all of that. Overly protective. I saw a lady that came through the camp there with I-58 in Greece, and she was traveling alone. I think she had three small children. She had had a horrific journey trying to get to that point. They had to cross on a dangerous boat ride to get there. I think one of the children, she had lost track of where one of the children was, and when she got there, she was just that paranoid, she couldn't sleep. She didn't know anybody. She didn't trust anybody. She got put in this building with how many other families, and she just couldn't sleep. I mean, because she couldn't close her eyes for fear of what was going to happen to her children. She almost went crazy because of the situation that was in. So trying to be aware of all of that helps you start to factor in then when we're at the clinic and there's too many people to be seen. And so you have to send half the population or half the people who was there and they start screaming at you, you're Hitler. You're Stalin. All kinds of ugly names. And you're saying, I'm just trying to show the love of Jesus to you. And you're calling me every ugly name that you can think of. And that can hurt because you just think you've given up whatever you did to be there and serve and your love, trying to show love to these people, and they're screaming at you. And you're thinking, well, I'm just wasting my time. These people hate me. But when you understand where they've come from, you can understand a better the range of emotions that you're experiencing as you see that. Another thing to think about if you're going to do distributions is, how are you going to do a distribution? Okay. We got 5 minutes. How are we going to do a distribution? Especially in an uncontrolled environment. That's a dangerous combination. You would think it wouldn't be, but if you drive into a camp full of people and you've got a truckload of items and you didn't do your homework, you're set up to get hurt. There's a million people and you've got 100 items. Are you kidding me? It doesn't take much brains for the people standing there to say, it ain't going to reach, I'm getting some, and you just have all out going. And as much as I don't like it, some of the best distributions that I've been involved in involve the police. It involved the military. They were in control. In fact, in that camp, there in the Rohingya camp, you can't do a distribution. You're not allowed to. You go to the army post, you give them the items that you have, they'll tell you where it's going to be distributed, and you are welcome to be there, but the government, the army, is going to do the distribution. They're the ones who carry the stick and make people stand in lines and don't run over everything, and bring a little bit of safety to the thing. We were at one part of the camp one day, and they were getting ready to do a distribution, and it was hose and water cans and some things like that, stuff that you wouldn't even think there'd be a fight over. That looked like work, right? Not food. They had a bamboo fence around this building, and a whole bunch of Rohingya volunteers were inside the fence getting ready to help do the distribution. And the crowd on the outside got bigger, and after a while they got bigger, and they got the pushing, and after a while they pushed the gate over, and they started coming in, and the Rohingya guys on the inside picked up bamboo poles, and they were at each other. Rohingya on Rohingya, swinging bamboo sticks, and they weren't threatening each other. They weren't saying, "I'm going to hit you." They were swinging to hit and knock people out on both sides. I'll tell you what I did. I went out over the back fence. I bailed out over it. I went down through a ravine. I came up the other side. I stood on the other side and watched because it wasn't my distribution, and I had nothing to gain or lose by being there. But you need to have a plan if you're going to do a distribution, or things can end up being ugly for you. Violence. A lot of times you will find camps turn violent. You'll end up fires. You end up, and some of them are lit by their own people. They're lit by their own people. And you're like, how destructive can you be? Like, somebody just gave you this, and you turn around and burn everything down. Well, if you are a stateless people and you have no voice anywhere, nobody wants to listen to you. The country that you're in doesn't want you. The country that you ran away from disowned you. Who do you appeal to? We want attention. How do you get attention? Burn something. Light something on fire. We want attention. We got problems here and nobody's looking. So violence can break out very easily. Better have a plan on what you're going to do. Have an evacuation plan. Don't just get yourself caught in the middle of nowhere thinking that because you've been nice to everybody, they're all going to be nice to you, because there's going to be people in there that don't know you and things can go astray. Government regulations. You're stuck with government regulations. We are very restricted working in the Rohingya camp. We have to have all kinds of government papers filed. Only people with the right visas can be in there. Be aware of what's going on with the governments in the areas where you're trying to work with refugees. And I'm just going to wrap it up here now. I've ran out of time to say this. And my brother's a doctor, and he says that a doctor needs to be at his best when his patient is at its worst. And I think the same thing is true in a refugee context. We need to be at our best when the refugees are experiencing their worst. And that's when the light of Christ shines in a way that cannot be hid.
Thank you for listening. All recordings from Reach 2022 are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. To purchase additional recordings from Reach or other Faith Builders events, visit us online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769.